I always wanted to just put on races, but I also didn't want our races to fly under the radar. I felt like the way to play it was kind of reverse engineer it, build the platform first. All these events and racers were all like kind of reliant on other people to wield the spotlight and choose where they shine it. Believe it or not, when we launched Drag Illustrated, I think there was 9 other print titles that were technically drag racing related. Either they were a house organ, like NHRA has National Dragster, they largely cover their own events. IHRA at the time had Drag Review, but they only covered IHRA events. So as like what was clearly going to be an independent operation, I felt like we needed to develop our own magazine media outlet. And then at one point in the future, we would have what I felt was like the heft, if you will, to put on our own events and ensure that they got the attention they deserved.
With our special guest today, Wes Buck, founder, creator, Drag Illustrated. Eat, Sleep, Raise podcast. We're recording live here at the PRI podcast studio with our special guest today, Wes Buck, founder, creator, Drag Illustrated, World Series of Pro Mod. Accolades can go on. Wes, run it down.
Oh my goodness.
Entrepreneur at heart.
Yeah, man. I mean, yeah, Drag Illustrated is really our core business. It's kind of like the foundational piece of what we do and everything I kind of consider like a silo that we've built on that foundation. But we got into the event space in 2017, started putting on our own events. That started with the Drag Illustrated World Series of Pro Mod. That has now evolved into a 3-race series, which we announced a few months ago, the Drag Illustrated Winter Series. 3 races. All 3 contested at Bradenton Motorsports Park. We've got a slew of different podcasts. My podcast, The Wes Buck Show. We've got Racing Business with Jason Dukes. We've got Who You Got with JT Hudson and Elon Warner. We also have, what's our Monday morning show? Reaction Time with Kayla Zadell. So we got a slew of different shows that we create. The magazine, we've been publishing the magazine for 20 years almost. It's 191 issues that we've put out. We've got subscribers all around the world. We mail to damn near every continent, every country, and really dived into social media and have developed a fairly significant presence on social media. So that's a big part of what we do as well.
I think that the greatest thing that you've done is build a community of drag racers, and it happened organically, if anything, for you to come into the event space, for you guys to all your subscribers naturally from your magazine. You doing coverage of other people's events to you 10 over a decade later to doing your own events is actually long overdue, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I always wanted to just put on races. That's what I wanted to do. Like, whenever we started the magazine, the goal was to put on races, but I also didn't want our races to fly under the radar or be insignificant or just be part of the mix. I wanted to, you know, we're not here to take part, we're here to take over. And I knew that if I felt like the way to play it was kind of reverse engineer it, build the platform first. So we went into it and I said, we'll do the media company and develop our own. All these events and racers were all like kind of reliant on other people to wield the spotlight and choose where they shine it. And I knew at the time with the landscape, believe it or not, when we launched Drag Illustrated, I think there was 9 other print titles that were technically drag racing related. And it was tough to like break into some of those things. They were a house organ, like NHRA has National Dragster. They largely cover their own events. IHRA at the time had Drag Review, but they only covered IHRA events. So as like what was clearly going to be an independent operation, I felt like we needed to develop our own magazine media outlet. And then at one point in the future, we would have what I felt was like the heft, if you will, to put on our own events and ensure that they got the attention they deserved.
So the events were always in the business plan then?
Yeah, my first job in drag racing, I was 21 years old, and I got an opportunity to be the general manager of a little 8-mile drag strip in southeast Iowa. It was like the track that I grew up going to. So it was like my dad and I raced there every weekend, and it's a long story, but I got an offer to basically uproot from Missouri and move to Iowa and take over this racetrack. And I did that. And so my background is really primarily, like, that was my first gig, but I had done some promotion locally with some events and stuff in the past. I was like the youngest IHRA track operator they'd ever had. I was 21 when I took the job. And I learned a tremendous amount during my time at the racetrack. But during that is when I ultimately launched Drag Illustrated and cooked up that concept, because we, as a track, we were having a hell of a time. Like, I couldn't figure it out. We were putting on some really incredible races, but we couldn't get any, like, national media coverage. Not, like, from Fox or ESPN, but, like, the drag rags. Like, all the drag magazines, all the websites. There were some emerging websites at the time, and there was nothing I could do to get them to write about it. It was exhausting, and we ultimately had to take matters into our own hands.
So, let's go back.
Yeah.
How did you get into drag racing?
You know, some kids grew up playing baseball and basketball and football and whatnot. I went racing with my old man. That's all I've ever done. It's honestly all I've ever cared to do.
What type of drag racing was he doing?
So my dad was like a fast door slammer guy. So we're like tried and true, dyed in the wool door slammer guys. So pro stock is really what our dream always was. NHRA pro stock. We never had the resources or like the financial wherewithal to go run NHRA national events, but we basically had outdated NHRA pro stock style cars. My dad was a do-it-yourselfer. My dad still to this day runs an auto repair shop in Northeast Missouri. He's been there for 41 years. He says he can fix anything but a broken heart, you know, and they have a tremendous business there. And I went racing with my dad. I mean, that was what I spent. I mean, literally every night in the shop, every weekend at a racetrack. And it was just part, I grew up in this community. I was literally in my mother's womb a week before I was born at the drag strip. So I've spent my entire life here, and I fell in love. Like, the racing is great, the cars are great and all those things, but this is a group of people you mentioned earlier, a community that is like the salt of the earth. Like, these are all of the best people I know drag race. And I just wanted to find a way to stay involved in the sport. But that's really how it started. And I crewed on my dad's car. He had when we really started getting serious, he had 97 Don Ness Oldsmobile Cutlass, which I still to this day think are the best looking race car ever. They look kind of boxy, but they're actually like sleek and aerodynamic. They cut through the air really well. And he bought a Don Ness Olds Cutlass and had an outdated 500 cubic inch naturally aspirated engine in it with a Liberty 5-speed. So we were always clutch guys. We always stick shift stuff. And my dad competed in a lot of different. So my dad and both of his brothers, my two uncles, Buck Brothers, that was Buck Brothers Racing. And the three of them all had fast door cars, like high 4-second cars, which at the time was flying, 8th mile cars, run like 470s, 480s in the 8th mile. And we picked it up a little bit, but there's a really cool organization in the Midwest called the Ozark Mountain Super Shifters. And it's all manually shifted race cars, no electronics. So it's kind of a blast from the past type of deal. But we joined that series and we toured all around the Midwest. It was like an exhibition. So we'd come in, there'd be 20, 30 of us, and we would like put on a show, big burnouts, staging duels. It was really, really cool. So we got to be a part of a lot of big events, but that was kind of like my first foray into the sport. And that's how I got involved.
So you basically, family brought you in. There's basically two paths to this, right? You go down that path of drag racing, be a racer itself. Yeah. And you went the other. So, like, what made you kind of go the other way?
It's funny, man. My brother picks on me and says I'm awkward with tools. I take it pretty hard. I've gotten a lot better. But I never had. My kid brother, Bradley, has that mechanical knack. I mean, he can fix anything. He's a brilliant guy. Every toy he ever had growing up, tore it apart immediately, tore it into pieces to try to see if he could put it back together. I was never like that. I was more artsy-fartsy. I was always messing with computers. Like, when I was 15, 16 years old, I was building websites, taught myself HTML. Like, I was trying to, that was always what I was into. Video games, graphic design, all that type of stuff. And a little bit of a bullshitter by nature. I like to talk, you know what I mean? I like to be a part of the conversation. So whenever I was growing up, it was quickly, you know, I don't have the financial resources to go drag racing at the level I want to. And I was like really scared graduating high school, like starting to like see manhood coming down the road. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do because all I want to do is go drag race. And I'm not a fabricator. I'm not a super talented welder. I'm not a super talented mechanic. And I wanted to find my way to drag racing, but I didn't know how I was going to do it. So I felt like the play for me was to take the skills that I did have, gift of gab, I guess, and some arts and crafts type of experience and production experience and turn it into a business.
So that's how Drag Illustrated came about.
Yeah, man. I mean, honestly, in the fall of 2005, I looked around the sport of drag racing and I was still running the racetrack, but that deal was kind of, the track was going to be sold and there was going to be new ownership. So I knew that I was going to have to start looking for whatever was next. And as I told you guys earlier, we were struggling with coverage. And I look around the sport And I recognized there was a ton of tracks and promoters. Like, a lot of the coolest things happening in the sport of drag racing at the time were getting no media love, no ink whatsoever. And growing up, like, my dad, I know drag racing is one of the most brutal hobbies or passions you can dive into. I mean, you're going to lose a lot. You're never going to make any money. You're going to spend a ton of it. It's a tough thing. And a lot of these men and women, what they really need or what they're really seeking is some validation. I remember my dad used to buy classified ads in the back of National Dragster with no intention of selling his car, just so he could have it on the counter at the shop and flip it open and show somebody that his car was in a magazine. You know what I mean? And I mean, those are like postage stamp size photos. And as I got older, I recognized that almost all these guys and gals feel the same way. They just want to feel like someone cares. They, you know, they want to show this stuff off. They want to show it to their employees that work all week to help them afford to go racing or what have you, their family, their wife that sees them run out the door every Friday morning to head to the racetrack. And that little bit of validation goes a long way to this group of people. So I was looking at the sport, and at the time, in the fall of 2005, the ADRL was coming alive, the American Drag Racing League, which was a sharp focus on pro-modified outlaw-style door slammer racing. ORSCA, I'm not sure if you remember ORSCA, the Outlaw Racing Streetcar Association. That's where Outlaw 10-5 and drag radial racing was, like, born there. Events like the World Street Nationals in Orlando. There was all these incredible things. The Street Machine Nationals in Rogersville, Missouri. There was all these killer events that got no coverage at all. And it's like, how are those things going to grow? How are we going to keep this part of our sport headed in the right direction if these guys aren't getting any of that validation, the sponsors aren't getting any attention? So our goal with Drag Illustrated was to create, I always say, like, imagine the NFL or any stick and ball sport without Sports Illustrated. If every team had their own magazine, like Cowboys Illustrated, Chiefs Illustrated, Giants Illustrated, it would always be pretty biased and slanted. You know what I mean? Like, we only lost because they cheated. You know what I mean? And that's kind of what existed in drag racing. Every organization had their own house organ, and it was, I'm not going to say slanted, but it was definitely focused on what they did. And there was no, very little independent journalism happening in the sport of drag racing. And my goal was to bring us all together. How can we bring this community together? There's a lot of walls that have been built over decades and decades and decades in this sport. You know, imports versus domestics, prep versus no prep, big tire versus small tire. I mean, there's all these, I always joke, it's like a high school hallway.
Yeah.
It's clicked up. You know what I mean? Big time. And I felt like we had to start the process of tearing those walls down and recognizing that, as far as I'm concerned, if you've ever rolled through the water and done a burnout, you're my kind of guy. You know what I mean? And we can accomplish a lot more together than we can in our little pockets, in our own little spaces. So anyways, that was really the mission statement behind Drag Illustrated, was to tear those walls down and treat local yokel bracket racer the same way we treat John Force. Early on, we actually largely avoided covering any mainstream drag racing. But I recognize a lot of these guys want to be guilty by association. The local racer that's relatively unknown, it does a lot for him to see himself on the pages of a magazine alongside Ron Capps or Brittany Force or whoever. Yep. So about, I don't know, 5-6 years in, I go, you know what, we got to practice what we're preaching. You know, I've said all these things, and we're not really living up to our own standard. We've got to cover this whole sport. So that's when we started really diving into NHRA, IHRA, a variety of different sanctions and series that had their own magazines, but I wasn't going to let that deter us from covering them ourselves. And that's really the genesis of it. And, like, secondarily, I wanted to put faces to the names. Like, growing up, you'd see the names on the windows. You knew what car they drove, but you had no idea what they looked like.
Because they wore a helmet, and you didn't see their face.
You never see their face. You never saw them do an interview. You don't know what these guys sound like. You don't know how they, like, what they are as a person. And another analogy with publications is, like, Rolling Stone doesn't put guitars and drum sets on the cover of their magazine. They put the people who play them on the cover. And that's what we really have focused on over those 190-some issues that we've published, is very rarely, I think there's about 6 total that don't have, and it's for a reason, that don't have a human face on them. Because I want people to know who these people are. Because despite what anybody may have said in the past, the cars are not the stars. They're a big part of what we do, but they are most certainly secondary to the men and women behind the wheels of these machines and standing behind them and working on them in the pits. Going back to the community, like, this is a cool, exciting, every one of these guys and gals have a story. They have some interesting way they have found, you know, themselves in the sport of drag racing. And we just wanted to share those stories and start connecting people emotionally. It's hard to It's like impossible to actually have like a real meaningful connection or like an emotional connection with a piece of machinery, you know, but you can fall in love with one of these guys or appreciate what they do or where they come from. Maybe they're a farmer. Maybe they're a general contractor. Maybe they got an HVAC business. Well, that's how you get a hook in somebody, because most people are never going to go 300 miles an hour or drive a 5,000 horsepower race car. But if you can find a way to get those fans and get the people in the stands to connect to them via their background or their story or where they live or what they do, it's a way to get them coming back. Like, the cars bring us out, but the people bring us back.
I appreciate how you bring that up, because as an influencer yourself, living in an influencer era, if not content creator era, if you do your job right, you become an influencer. This segues into two different topics. One, put it in the back of your head, what could other event promoters, organizations do better? But before we even get to that topic, every racer has a story, right? A lot of people are very relatable to other racers, aspiring racers. If not, you know, you're the biggest advocate, if in my opinion, of pro mod racing, right? So every racer there has a story. I see the downside to a lot of media out there, especially media who focus on only taking pictures or videos of race cars, who unfortunately are the majority of media these days. Yeah. The failure there to help back up your mission and what you've been doing is no one's covering what's happening in the pit and the people outside of the track besides the race day. All the coverage is literally the cars going down the track.
It's exhausting. I mean, if I every weekend, we Drag Illustrated as a group, my team covers about 100 events a year, personally attends 100 drag races a year. And every Monday, it never fails, I'll get a batch of photos, and 97 of the 100 they send are front burnout shots, three-quarter launch shots. It's like, guys, I've got so many of these that I don't even know what we would ever do with them. Millions of photos in our archives. And it's like, so I have actually challenged our photographers to spend at least an entire session in the staging lanes and spend an entire session in the pits, because you're going to get a burnout shot. You're going to get a shot of that car. And I understand you don't want to miss anything. And that's one of the things, like, if we can do more for the media as a sport at some point, because what's lost on a lot of these track owners, event operators, most of these guys are donating their time. Most of these guys aren't making any money shooting pictures, doing this. They're doing this because they love it and they want a front row seat. So we've got to find a way, and we take great pride in taking good care of our photographers, whether they're staff members or freelancers. We take a lot of pride in trying to treat those guys right, because I've done it. I've slept in the tower. I've slept in my car, my Lumina, at some racetrack overnight because I couldn't afford a hotel. I know what a lot of those cats go through, and we've got to find a way to continue to do more and more and more for them. And that's, we pour a lot of energy into trying to turn, you're talking about influencers and a creator era that we're in. I'm a big believer in personal brand. Like, it's the sooner you're famous, the sooner you're successful. Like, whether you've got to be, it's not the best, it's the best known. You know, and I challenge my guys all the time to, like, make sure you put yourself out there. I don't even do a good enough job of it. I'm better at telling people to do it than I am doing it myself. But it's really important. And we've turned, like, a lot of our photographers are celebrities. It's a big deal when Van Abernathy comes to your race. It's a big deal when John Ford III comes to your race. It's a big deal when Rick Belden shoots your photo for the cover. He's our portrait photographer. I mean, those things, it's a big deal when Chris Sears shows up. And we've tried to, you know, build some celebrity around those guys so that, A, they never struggle to get a credential. You know what I mean? They're never going to get any, you know, drama from anybody. They're welcomed everywhere they go, but it's celebrated. Not only welcomed, but celebrated wherever they go.
You've seen a lot of races. Obviously, your guys have been to a lot of races. You read your magazine. What's the craziest drag race story that you have for us?
Well, I'll tell you, the one happened, we don't have enough time for me to tell you all the crazy
give
stuff.
Give us the short.
Well, I'll tell you, just notes. This last week, my favorite, what happened this last weekend at the Snowbird Outlaw Nationals, I'm sure you saw it on the internet, but Stevie Jackson going over to the Freedom Factory. A lot of these cars, I mean, a fresh set of tires is typically worth like a hundredth in ET. Bad, right? Most of these pro-level race teams scuff their tires, so they'll want to go do two or three big burnouts and get those tires scuffed in before they actually go make a run in competition. So Stevie Jackson, one of our superstars of the pro-modified world and a big star of what we're doing in the Drag Illustrated Winter Series, he's outside of the field, looking in, final qualifying coming up on Saturday night. He knows that he's going to have to run like a low 3.6 second pass in the eighth mile to get qualified for the show. But he's having a tire issue, so they need to put a new set of tires on the car. But he knows that hundredth of a second could keep him out of the field. So they haul this thing over to Cletus McFarland's. They tow it over to Cletus McFarland's Freedom Factory right there on the property at Bradenton Motorsports Park. And they decide to do a burnout over there on his burnout pad. Well, he's got a Christmas tree thing over there, a bunch of Christmas lights. Can't use the nice concrete burnout pad. Let's do it on this little entrance road into the track. So Stevie goes out there, got the front end off of the car, rips off this big crazy burnout, loops the old girl out, hits a Crown Vic, sideways through some Christmas trees into a Crown Victoria that had been used at the Freedom, at the 2.4 hours of Le Mullets a couple weeks earlier, smacks this Crown Vic and has to make a run in like an hour. And I mean, he's on the outside looking in at the biggest pro mod race in the history of the known universe. So they bring that thing back to the pits, cut up some cooking sheets and all this stuff, duct tape the whole side of the car back together and go up there and rip off like a 362 and qualify for the field. I mean, that was happened a week ago.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to me, it was like a testament to just what these folks are willing to do, how hard they're willing to work to go up there and try to go racing on Sunday. It's an incredible thing, man.
In the few minutes we've been together right now, you mentioned a lot of names. Francis had a question.
I don't know if this is going to get touchy or not, but we were going to say top three, but I said, all right, let's make this a little bit more liberal. Can you give us your favorite racers? Name your favorite racers.
My favorite drag racer of all time is Shannon the Iceman Jenkins. I don't know if you're familiar with Shannon, but he was a pro modified icon all throughout the mid to late 90s, well into the early 2000s. He's a pioneer in pro modified drag racing, and he's just cool. He's always got a Marlboro light hanging out of his mouth, and he's from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and just, they call him the Iceman for a reason. I've never seen the guy riled up, never seen him fired up. He constantly won races because of him. His cars always ran well, but he would be the difference maker. Never going to leave on Shannon, never going to get him rattled in that car, and he is without a doubt my favorite drag racer of all time, and he was actually on the cover of Drag Illustrated issue number one. That was the first decision I made when we sat down. We were at a Perkins and we were cooking up ideas for different stories in the magazine, and who are we going to put on the cover? And I said, well, that's decided. Shannon Jenkins is going on the cover. So he's my all-time favorite drag racer. Modern era right now, so many of them. I do have a real penchant for pro mod drag racing. I think it's the future of our sport. I think a lot of people are kind of sensitive to how much I talk about pro modified, but I look at it through the lens of scalability. And right now, there are more pro-modified cars on the planet Earth than any other class of heads-up pro-level drag racing.
How many pro-mods were there?
250 pro-mods earned points in North America alone during the 2024 season. I mean, 250. We had 64 cars at our event. Our events are invite-only. We choose the best of the best, the cream of the crop. We go out and we select those guys. I personally connect with every single one of them and invite them to come be a part of what we're doing. I'm really selective about it. I'm more worried about personality and culture than I am how your car runs. You got to fit the locker room. You got to fit and share the vision and see what we're trying to do and believe in us. But yeah, I mean, there's so many pro. I venture to say there's 500-600 in the world that are like legit pro modified style cars. And if you compare and contrast that to any other pro level class, I mean, there's probably not 30 top fuel cars in the world. You know, there's probably not 30 good funny cars in the world. So there's probably 30 good pro mod cars within an hour of here. You know what I'm saying? And for me, I look at it in terms of inventory. It's like we've got an inventory of these cars, and that's a very important piece. If we're going to build something, we got to have that inventory. I can't hope another super rich guy is going to get, that's a thrill seeker, is going to get a bug to go pro mod racing or whatever. I see there. This is where the energy is at in our space right now, and everything has its life cycle. But pro mod has really defied a lot of trends in our sport. We've seen all these different things, import racing, hottest thing in the world, and then it fades, right? Outlaw 10.5 was the hottest thing in the world, and then it fades. Drag radial racing, the hottest thing in the world, and then it starts to fade. Pro mod has maintained a really consistent presence since the late 80s. It's always been there. It's always been this kind of like rare beast that existed in the sport of drag racing. And I think it's just because it's really true to what this community is all about. I mean, this is a bunch of badasses and outlaws, roughneck guys, blue collar people, and pro modified speaks to them. I joke, and people get sensitive about this as well, but it's really the highest level of grassroots drag racing. It's because it's still guys that are driving their own trucks, putting up their own awnings, working on their own cars. Sure, there's some hired gun drivers in our space, and as it continues to grow, we'll see more of that. But there's still a whole lot of independent operations, guys that are doing it with their kids, guys that are doing it with just their wife. And I think that's really the magic of it right now is it's a super eclectic and diverse group of people, but man, there are a lot of them.
What do you think, you know, you said it, right? ProMod has a really good inventory. What do you think we need to do to continue to have that inventory for the future?
Man, it's the biggest thing is trying to maintain or manage some of the cost. You know, heads up drag racing, pretty much all drag racing. And I think it's one of the things that has been a barrier to entry for our sport is there's really no cheap way to go drag racing. I mean, I love that our sport is the only motorsport basically where you can drive your car straight off the track or straight off the public roadway and into competition at a drag strip. I mean, it's the classic get in where you fit in motorsport. So there's a ton of opportunities for people to get involved. But if you want to have a fast car or get a car that requires a trailer, now you need a truck. Now you need all this equipment to work on it. So it's a big bite for a lot of people. And I think if we can somehow marry up two things, we've got to pay these guys more money. You know, I'm proud of what we do at the Drag Illustrated Winter Series. The event this past weekend paid $50,000 to win in Pro Modified. The U.S. Street Nationals coming up at the end of January pays $75,000 to win. And the Drag Illustrated World Series of Pro Mod in March will pay $150,000 to win. So the money is headed in the right direction. But you're still never going to be able to pay these guys enough to offset what they've invested, you know, and it can become about the money, like too much. So I think you got to pay them good money. It's got to be big enough to get some, you know, get people excited, and you need a big number on your flyer and all those things. And you want people talking about it. But I think if we can try to find a way to maintain or manage the expense associated with it, we've seen that be a big contributor to, you know, we were just talking about Nitro Funny Car and Top Fuel. Man, those things run on money, and they just destroy parts. And that is something that I can't let happen in ProMod. Right now, I think the biggest issue that I'm facing is how some of these teams have the ability to go test all the time. They're spending weeks at racetracks. I mean, I've got teams that have Bradenton rented for the next 6 weeks. I mean, they're going all over. They're going to Orlando. They're going all over. They're going to Valdosta, the South Georgia Motorsports Park, and they will test weekly until the next race. But there's a small group of our guys that can do that. Most of these people are small business owners. They've got a job. They've got something they've got to do during the week. And testing is super expensive. I mean, you're running the car the same way you would in competition. So you're tearing things up. You've got to have your whole crew there. You got to fly everybody there. You got to get the rig there. I mean, Clay Milliken, one of my dear friends, a Top Fuel racer, he told me that every year the top line item on their P&L is the biggest expense they have is diesel fuel. So I think finding ways to try to manage some of the costs associated with running these cars, it's the curse of heads-up drag racing that it's going to be expensive and it's really hard. But if I can get everybody bought in to believe that and support that vision, I think we can keep it alive for a long time. I mean, there are more cars being built right now. If you call any chassis shop in the country, they're building Pro Mods.
With that being said, who should not race a Pro Mod?
Pansies. This is certified badasses only. The biggest issue that I see a lot of these guys have is not being able to hold the fucking gas pedal down. I mean, you'd be blown away how many runs are lost or cars don't perform the way they should because the guy started to ease his foot off the throttle. You know what I mean? And I think that's something that gets overlooked a lot in our sport is the courage, the balls it takes to strap into these things. I mean, you're going, the eighth mile is two city blocks, 660 feet. So these cars are going 0 to 220 miles an hour in 3.6 seconds. They weigh 2,700 pounds sometimes. If they hit something, nothing positive is coming from it. These are super dangerous cars. And I honestly think we sleep on the courage that it takes to be in these cars, because about anybody can drive one, but very few people can do it well and do it well consistently. So that's who shouldn't drive Pro Mods. Anybody that's not a certified badass.
And then also we spoke about you select and personally invite 60 so racers to the event out of an existence of 500 cars. That means over 400 upset people who would like to race at that event potentially. For anyone who wants to get into the event business, what should they be ready to do?
The event business?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the question is, if you want to get into event production, what should you be ready to do?
have people mad at you. You know, that's probably the thing that I've struggled with the most. I'm a people pleaser by nature. Like, that's just who I am. It's who I've always been. I wear my heart on my shirt sleeve. I'm sensitive, probably too sensitive. My dad made fun of it, made fun of me for it my whole life. We got to toughen you up. You know, you got to get thicker skin. And I do, admittedly. It's definitely a flaw. And I care a lot about this stuff. So it's like amplified with how passionate I am about what we're doing. But I'd say that be ready to have some people mad at you. I try to, you can take the smartest, most logically minded human being on the planet and have them put a helmet on, and they
goes out the door.
It goes out the door, right? And that's the biggest thing, is just being prepared for the battle that it is, because you really want to, you got to want to do it. I talk to a lot of promoters like, hey, I'm thinking about doing this, or I want to do this. And I ask them, like, are you really hungry enough to do this? Because it's more than money. It's more than a network. I mean, you've got to want to do it really bad. And I mean, I get myself so spun out before these events that I'm not sleeping. I mean, but I love it. And it makes it easy for me to do it because I love it so much. So you better love it, and you better have thick skin.
And I mean, obviously it's an ego-driven sport, dealing with your field, at least 60 something racers. That's 60 different egos. Everyone wants to win. People always want the edge. So you have some cheating that happens. You have people contesting rules. For anyone trying to get into doing events, it's no walk in the park.
No, the rules are probably, especially in Pro Modified, part of the magic of this particular brand of drag racing is there's a variety of different ways to do it. So Pro Modified racing in the late 80s was all nitrous cars. It was like pretty much all a big block Chevy with a sheet metal tunnel ram on it, two carburetors, and a nitrous system. That's kind of how Pro Modified started. Then we saw the introduction of the supercharger, the Root style supercharger. Then we saw go from a wedge-headed style engine to the hemispherical-headed engines, and that was kind of another different variation of Pro Modified. And so for years and years and years, trying to balance those two combinations was really hard, because a supercharged engine makes more horsepower than a nitrous engine, so you'd have the nitrous cars are a little lighter weight, the supercharged cars are a little heavier, and that was kind of how you got them close. Since those early days, we now, at this past weekend, we had a twin-turbo combination that is our most powerful combination. Most of these cars are making 5,000-plus horsepower. Then we also, our next most powerful combination would be the screw-type supercharger. Then we have root-style supercharger. Then we have centrifugal superchargers, and we also have nitrous oxide cars. So trying to balance all the different performance or power adders is the biggest challenge we face every year. And it's a battle, because every one of them, as you said, want the edge, right? They want to have the favorable combination. And that's pretty much the biggest topic of discussion before and after all of our races, is how are they going to get these guys close? And I'm proud to say, for the last 2 years down in Bradenton, in 2023, we had our 30, we take the top 32 cars. So the quickest 32 race on Sunday. Our 32-car field that consisted of all those aforementioned combinations, nitrous, turbos, blowers, oh my, was spread across 56 hundredths of a second. So this year, we matched the World Series in 24 at the race we just had, the Snowbird Outlaw Nationals. 32 cars spread across 6 hundredths of a second.
Wow, that's crazy.
I mean, it's absolutely insane, and it puts even more pressure and onus on those drivers, because everybody's car can run the number. There's nobody here that's just going to go up there and outrun you dramatically. And I was so proud. I mean, we had a No Prep King star, Kai Kelly, with a steel roof and quarters, IROC Camaro that is much shorter wheelbase than the traditional Pro Mod car, goes down there, wins the race, qualifies for the quickest Pro Modified in the field in the history of drag racing. Like, nobody saw that coming.
Was that his first? Because he's an MPK guy, right?
He's an MPK guy, and he had run one other Pro Mod race, just showed up to kind of like test and shake down a new car. But I reached out to him actually over a year ago, because I wanted him to come to the World Series back in 2023, and he just didn't feel like he could be competitive enough and didn't want to go down there and not, you know, look silly or anything like that. But I convinced him to come to this event, and he ended up winning the deal. It was a really, I mean, we couldn't have scripted that. We couldn't have asked for a better outcome than that. I mean, there was a part of me that's like, oh man, I kind of want my Pro Mod guys to run over top of these MPK dudes, you know, but there's a lot of good guys in that community that are great for our sport, that have huge fan followings. And there was an opportunity to leverage that and continue to tear these walls down, you know, because I mean, for me, it was cool to see like pro modified drag racing legends, you know, standing in the staging lanes and chumming it up with Kai Kelly and Justin Swanstrom and these dudes that, you know, have kind of built their brand on the back of reality television to bring those worlds together. We also had Antron Brown, who's an NHRA Top Fuel, just won the NHRA Top Fuel World Championship. He was down there in a pro mod car. NHRA Pro Stock, six-time NHRA Pro Stock World Champion Erica Enders was down there in a pro mod car. And that's really the vision for the Drag Illustrated Winter Series. The reason we do it in the winter is because I don't ever want... I do business and support all these other sanctions and series in the sport of drag racing. And I didn't ever want to... I've done that with my dad, as I said. I mean, I remember my dad having to make a conscious decision who we were going to piss off because there was a race on top of each other. Well, we could go to Eddyville, Iowa, or we could go to Earlville, Iowa, or we could go to Cordova. They've all got, you know, events this weekend, and I remember how much stress he felt knowing that he was going to let one of those guys down because he was going to have to pick one. And I never want to put our fans or our racers in a position to have to choose to support me over somebody else. And so we developed this winter series, three races inside of 90 days, crazy payouts, crazy publicity, crazy promotion, but bring people from all walks of the racing life. Like, if I had my way, we'd have NASCAR driver that, you know, races in the NASCAR series all year long, but then they come down and they jump behind the wheel of a pro mod for 3 months out of the year and see how they fare against, you know, the baddest dudes on the planet Earth. And we've started down that path here where, you know, I want Antron Brown to go defend his title in Top Fuel, but when freaking November and December rolls around, I want him to put that thing in the trailer and go get the pro mod out and get ready to go outlaw racing.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You mentioned, obviously, you want the growth of the sport in general, just like I think anyone in this industry, right? So your events are just an addition to every drag racing as a whole, right? Let me phrase this correctly. What should other organizations or other promoters do better?
Care more. I mean, the biggest thing that I see in our sport is I think a lot of the people that are in positions of power and have significant influence in this space have never raced themselves. They don't know what it's like to stand on top of an aluminum trailer and put an awning out in 115-degree sun. They've never had to lay in the sand at Bradenton and try to work on their car. They've never had to run to Home Depot and grab some plywood to throw down in the pits because where they're pitted, you know, it rained last night and now it's soaked and the car's underwater. I think that a lot of people are a little bit disconnected from the realities of going drag racing and just how hard it is. I mean, most of these guys are fighting real serious battles just to get to the track. And I feel like what we do is we care. We care a lot about these people, and we recognize and we understand how hard this is, and they could do something else. They could buy a bass boat, right? They could go golfing. A lot of these guys can afford to do whatever they want in their free time. So the fact that they choose to go drag racing is not lost on me or anybody on my team. And I think that that's the thing that if I had to impart any advice to somebody is these people deserve respect. They deserve to be appreciated for what they're doing. Most of them aren't making any money. Very few people are making any money drag racing. So the fact that they volunteer to come do this means a lot to me. So I think that the tip of the sword is caring about these people, treating them with the reverence that they deserve, cheering them on, celebrating their successes. I mean, we make a big deal out of the winner's circle, right? You guys have been a part of our events in the past. I never miss an opportunity to throw a party, and we turn our winner circle into a party. We're typically the photo shoot at a winner circle at a Drag Illustrated event. That's a 2-3 hour endeavor. We're going to hose you down with champagne, throw money at you. We're going to party. We're going to listen to music because I want them to know that I care, and I want to create a core memory because, like, that's the important part. I want them to leave and never, ever, ever forget when they won a Drag Illustrated race. So we're taking 10,000 photos. We're doing everything we can, shooting videos. That stuff is important. And I think it's easy as a promoter to be like, well, we got to prep the track. We got to run the schedule. We got to do this. But it's these kind of intangible happenings around it. Like, our on-track product is unparalleled in this sport. No doubt, drag racing is the great American motorsport. But where we have historically missed it a little bit, is everything that goes around the racing, the production, the pomp and circumstance. I mean, we dress the house in the production world. That's what it's called. You go to a venue, you dress the house. I don't see that anywhere else in drag racing, very minimally, you know, because it's like, oh, let's go hang some banners on a fence. No, man, let's get this place cleaned up. Let's get this place looking nice. And create a vibe, create an atmosphere. But that really, Brian, to kind of conclude that question, is that's rooted in caring. Because at the end of the day, I don't feel like anything we're doing is that special. I think we're just simply giving this group of people, this community, what they deserve. I mean, from the fans to the racers to the sponsors, this is what they deserve.
Can we switch gears real quick?
Yeah.
Since we are at PRI, and you just came from 30 under 30.
Yep.
What made you do that?
Man, we celebrated 10 years of the Drag Illustrated 30 Under 30 this year. It's a really cool program that, honestly, over some moonshine here in the halls of the PRI show, we were tearing our booth down one day, and I had a dear friend of mine, PJ North, who's a drag racer and a musician, a super talented kid, and we were sitting around, as I said, having a couple of cocktails or whatever. One of our longtime subscribers brought over some moonshine, and we were making some questionable decisions, and we got to talking about some of the same things that we've been talking about. How do we grow this deal? How do we get kids involved? And I told him the same thing I told you guys. Man, we need to just validate their efforts. I went drag racing with my dad my whole life. I never got a letter jacket. You know what I'm saying? I never got to go get my picture taken with the team in the high school gym because I was never on one. And we started talking, and I said, man, we got to find a way to recognize these young folks and, like, let them know that someone's paying attention, someone cares, someone's proud of them, and cheer them on because this is going to be a rough go of it. Right? A lot of late nights, early mornings, a lot of trials and tribulation associated with this sport. And we need to make sure that those kids know that we're proud of them and we're going to cheer them on. And that was pretty much the genesis of the Drag Illustrated 30 Under 30. So the very next year, we announced that we were going to select 30 young people, 30 people under the age of 30 that we felt were making a difference in the sport of drag racing. But we also wanted to be diverse with it. We didn't want it just to be drivers. We didn't want it to just be crew chiefs. So we made special effort over the years to make sure that this year we had fabricators. We had a really talented Monique Ambrosia flew all the way over here from Australia to walk up on that stage a few minutes ago and get her jacket. We do cool, badass 30 under 30 jackets because that's really harkens back to me never having a letter jacket. I'm like, these kids are going to have a letter jacket. They're going to have our version of a letter jacket.
How many people applied?
7,000 nominations we had this year. And it's one of the hardest things we do. It's similar to the rules because it's all very debatable. There's people that think it's a popularity contest, but we never factor that in. I mean, we like to have some names in there, and it always helps when you have someone that's well-known or what have you. But what we look at is, what are these people doing? What's their trajectory? You know, like, where are they going to be? And we also, I mean, I'm hard on these guys and gals, these with their social media. Like, if they're on social media acting a fool, twerking at the club or whatever, like, good for you. That's awesome. But you're probably not a good fit for what we're trying to do, you know? I mean, I've had plenty of kids that are world champions, won their local track championship, set some record. I go pull them up on Facebook and Instagram, and all I see is a bunch of stupidity. And I go, this kid's not a fit, you know? And I have to explain that to them or explain it to their parents. But, you know, this year we had 7,000 nominations. We pour over those. We typically try to get it down to a couple of hundred, and then we have a series of meetings. We have a big conference call, and all of my team is on there, and everybody kind of makes their pitches and has the people there circled or people that we think maybe had an exceptionally good year, and we start to have those conversations and slowly whittle it down to 30 people that walk across that stage.
To go back to the conversation of what event promoters can do better, I want to put it out into the world right now, whether Drag Illustrated does it, West Buck does it, anybody watching does it. The greatest success of Formula One was stagnant for many years, over a decade. But when Liberty Media Group from the United States bought Formula One and they did the first series of Drive to Survive, to this day, they credit the growth of F1 globally to the Netflix series. And they did exactly what you just spoke about. They highlighted everything off the track. When you watch that show, a small percentage of each episode is actually what happened during the race, but the majority of it is what happens behind the scenes. And that whole, everything that you mentioned about having to go to Home Depot, buy the wood, all the trials and tribulations prior to getting the car down the track, I think it could be highlighted way better. And whether you guys do it or, you know, somebody...
It's coming, boss. It's coming. I mean, I think that you look at Street Outlaws and what they achieved. I mean, that show is 10% racing. You know what I mean? If you
Correct.
Sit down and watch it, and I've timed it before, You know, that, and it's, but it's, there's examples of this everywhere. Like pro wrestling, I'm a big combat sports guy. I love WWE. I love UFC. Like, I love all these things. And because I think they do such a great job with their businesses and with their sports. But if you watch WrestleMania as an example, that's like an 8-hour show, five of which is cameos and interviews and BSing and whatnot.
Yeah.
Like, less than half of it is actually wrestling. So I think that that's, you know, my own son, Max, my little boy, well, he's not little anymore. He towers over me. He's 16 years old, but he, I've struggled to get him into cars. You know what I mean? He's a really smart kid. He's a musician. And that show, Formula One Drive to Survive on Netflix, got a hook in him. He watched it religiously, fell in love with Formula One. And now I would argue that he is like as big of a Formula One fan as I know. And it's kind of interesting because that's gotten him interested in drag racing because he has a different appreciation for motorsports now. And I think that's something we've got to recognize in this day and age. Like, we're kind of beyond the shade tree mechanic era. You know, these cars are complex. There are a lot of electronics and computers and all these things. So you don't see guys swinging engines in their driveways anymore. And you're not hanging out with your dad handing him wrenches because his car's got to get worked on at the dealership exclusively, right? So we've got to recognize there's other ways to find yourself in drag racing or in motorsports in general. And, I mean, who knows what Max will end up doing. But that TV show, that reality show changed him and got him interested in motorsports. And we need more of it. I mean, it's coming. As soon as I can... You know, these things, I joke, these races, these events, they all run on money, just like a race car, right? So we've been working on some partnerships, and we're working on some really cool stuff right now because that's the next step for us. I wrote an article. I can't believe I had the balls to write it. I was a lot ballsier when I was younger. But it was like the first few issues of the magazine. I wrote a story called 10 Things NHRA Must Do. And this was like in 2007 or 8. I literally said, we got to have a badass reality show, a badass video game, and a badass toy. Like, those things, look at what 164 scale monster trucks have done for Monster Jam. You know, none of those kids, like, they didn't, like, have a monster truck that they drove around in, but they had every one, Bigfoot, Snakebite, Gravedigger, they had every single one of them, and those kids end up buying a ticket and going to a Monster Jam event. They're probably driving a four-wheel drive truck or a bro-dozer or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, that, it grows our economy. It grows the sport and grows monster trucks. And I can't believe we don't have, like, we should have the coolest, drag racing should have the coolest toys ever. We should have the coolest video game ever. And we're making progress. Like, I'm working on a toy deal right now. I've got an awesome relationship with No Limit Drag Racing, the iPhone and Android drag racing video game. We do a ton of stuff with them. They actually put the winner of the World Series of Pro Mod. Whoever wins that race gets their car in the game so that fans can download the game and buy it and race that car. So, like, right now, Derek Ward, who won the 2024 World Series, his 68 Firebirds in the game. Spencer Hyde, who won the race in 23, his 69 Camaros in the game. So, like, we're headed down that path, and the next priority I have is a reality show.
I like it. Very glad to hear that. Wes, we could go for hours.
Yeah, man.
Part two will be in the pipeline.
Let's do it in New York.
We got to get you to New York, New Jersey area, long overdue. But let's keep it till the next episode.
You got it, boss.
Appreciate it. For everybody watching, if you enjoyed this episode, please make sure you like, comment, subscribe. Looking forward to the next episode, Eat, Sleep, Race Podcast. Oh, and if anybody wants to follow you on your social media,
Wes Buck Show on Instagram, dragillustrated.com, and you can follow along with everything we do with the Winter Series at thewinterseries.com.
@BrianESR on Instagram.
Frankie5ESR.
Till the next one.